Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest outrages from Donald Trump, again implying that someone should assassinate Hillary Clinton, who he blames for starting the Bertha movement. Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, joins us to discuss why Trump has any support at all, let alone enough likely voters to put him close to even with Hillary Clinton in the polls, and what Clinton and her impressive pantheon of political surrogates, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and Michelle Obama, can do to close the enthusiasm gap between Trump's motivated supporters and Hillary Clinton's voters, who appear to be more alarmed by the prospect that Donald Trump could be the next president of the United States than excited by a highly qualified candidate who could be the country's first female president. Then, with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren campaigning for Hillary Clinton over this weekend to win back the millennials who voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries but are now drifting to the Libertarian and Green third-party presidential candidates, we will speak with Harold Meyerson, an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. He joins us to discuss his latest article at The American Prospect, A Shifting Electoral Map Gives Democrats the Advantage, which indicates that while the move to third-party candidates appears to be helping Donald Trump, long-term demographic trends clearly favor progressives. Then finally, we will speak with Kevin O'Leary, a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter with Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. He joins us to discuss his latest book, Trump, The Roots of Rage, The Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat. With Donald Trump and the far right having captured the GOP, we will look into the shameful role of what James Fellows calls the Vichy Republican establishment, who have remained silent in the face of blatant racism and cynical serial lying, as well as outlining a seven-point plan to defeat Donald Trump. And joining us now is Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners and a senior strategist for Americans United for Change. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump and the White Supremacist Alt-Right Are a Threat to Our National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And, Bob, it's pretty clear that Donald Trump is a threat. You've got people like Colin Powell lamenting the fact that he's even running and even the idea of him becoming president is a nightmare. Bob Gates, a former Secretary of Defense, head of the CIA, has weighed in. All kinds of Republican national security heavyweights have all weighed in. There's just no question that this is an alarming prospect that this man could become president of the United States, and that there may well be a slow-motion mutiny in the intelligence and defense world if he does become president because he's so unfit for the job. Yet the person who's incredibly experienced in all of these fields, in foreign affairs, national security, etc., and has been in the White House for 8 years, Hillary Clinton, she should be like 20 points ahead. What's going on here?
Well, I think there are a number of factors to explain it. The most important of which is, of course, that there are a lot of people in America who have not had a raise for 30 years. And when you have a situation where we've had a 48% increase in gross domestic product per capita over the last 30 years, and median incomes have been stagnant until last year when they finally started going up for the first time, and since 2007 inched up. They came up actually significantly last year. But the fundamental thing is that a lot of people are unhappy. And so Trump says you should be unhappy because it's the immigrants, it's the Muslims, it's the other, the same line of attack that was used by right-wing nationalists in the 30s, the same line of attack that's being used by right-wing nationalists in Europe and a number of places right now. I mean, in fact, Trump, I think, could be seen as as part of a broader movement in the West that is essentially a revival of right-wing nationalism. Last time they became preeminent was World War II. And he is clearly of and by the billionaire class, he's not quite the Romney-esque kind of opponents that we were talking about in the past. This guy is really a right-wing nationalist. At least that's what the movement he has championed and called forth with his hate-filled rhetoric and so forth. Now, why is he being as successful as he has? I think that's one of the reasons. He's an outsider. He says, we're going to tear down the temple and start all over. You're unhappy? What can you lose? In fact, there are good news factors on the other side. He's offended massive percentage of the population. And I think, though we've seen, particularly this illness and so on the last week, Hillary's numbers dropped somewhat. I think they'll be on the way up now. You know, if we are able to mobilize ordinary people in this election, and that's a critical if, in proportionate numbers to the population, we'll win this election. The same way we won in 2012. You know, a lot of the polls in 2012 had the president down on Romney, and it turned out they did not properly predict who was going to vote. That's the central element. But nobody can take it for granted, and we've got to all work our hearts out for the next 50-plus days to make sure that everybody votes. Now, I have one other point. I don't want to keep going on a long stream here if you want to ask me something or say something, but yeah, let me just continue this one last point. People who say, oh, I don't like either of these candidates, I'm going to vote for a third party, or I'm just going to stay home, they are voting for Donald Trump. They should not be confused. The consequence will be to elect Donald Trump president because his followers are motivated. They will go to the polls. And so I don't think anyone who, you know, Bernie backers, anybody who's, you know, most Bernie backers are backing Hillary now. But, I mean, you know, nobody should fool themselves that they can sit this out and not be personally responsible for his victory if he were to win.
So, Bob Cremer, does it come down then to the extent, and you just mentioned this, the extent to which Donald Trump's voters are motivated compared to Hillary Clinton's voters being alarmed?
Well, I think there's a lot of motivation there, too, but we have to stoke that between now and the election. One of the big advantages we have on our side is that I think the Clinton campaign has a marvelous field organization compared to Trump, and an ability to close that is far surpasses his. Field matters in these elections, big time, particularly in these critical swing states. And when you get down to it, we have a message that's just so much more compelling to most ordinary Americans. I mean, you know, it's harder to convince people that what's bad for him is good for him than to convince him what's good for him is good for him. We've got the right on our side here.
Right.
What he has going for him is this notion of an outsider and his willingness to be an unabashed demagogue. And we know that demagoguery can be successful if it is not challenged forcefully, and it really is incumbent upon all of us to do that between now and this election coming up. You know, I don't want to open too many old wounds, but I just would point out that in 2000 and, what was it, 2000? Yeah, it was 2000. When Al Gore lost the presidency, he lost by 527 votes in Florida. A third-party candidate there, Ralph Nader, had 50,000 votes, had 527 of those gone another direction. There would have been no Iraq War, no Bush tax cuts for the rich, no collapse of the economy in 2008. It's quite remarkable the change in history that would have happened. We'd had climate change issues cooking much earlier. We can't afford not to vote in this upcoming election.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He's a partner in Democracy Partners and a senior strategist for Americans United for Change, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump and the White Supremacist Alt-Right Are a Threat to Our National Security. Now, this weekend, both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are campaigning in Ohio, where Donald Trump, according to the latest polls, is up 5%. And that's in spite of the fact that the popular governor there, Kasich, has not endorsed Trump. How do they reverse this? The thing that's extraordinary about Hillary Clinton is she's got the world's greatest surrogates. She's got her husband, who's a terrific campaigner. She's got Elizabeth Warren. She's got Bernie Sanders. She's got Joe Biden. And she's got the most popular president in terms of numbers now, I mean, for the longest time, Barack Obama. And his extremely capable and popular wife, Michelle. You'd think with that kind of pantheon, she'd be in great shape. So what can she do? Other people are doing a lot for her. What can she do?
Well, those are huge assets. And I would just say, by the way, Bernie, who is such a class act, and Elizabeth, who is such an inspiration and connects so intimately with people, I think can do a lot to help. You know, everybody doesn't have the same qualities. Hillary will make a magnificent president of the United States in terms of her ability to govern. You know, she's not as immediately charismatically attractive as somebody like Elizabeth. They can help supplement that. But and I think the other thing they can do that's just so important is provide a sense of energy and also make it really clear to people who might consider saying, well, I'm not sure I like either of these, that it's so critical to vote for them, or for her. Hillary, I think, is going to run a very good campaign in the balance of this election. I think she's going to be out there driving home the importance of preventing the alt-right, the nationalist right, from taking a foothold in the United States. I think she'll be painting a vision of her own in terms of the future of our economy and society that I think will be very compelling. She'll have the opportunity in the debates next week, the first debate a week from Monday, to, I think, draw a very sharp contrast with Trump, and I think it will be very helpful to her. Now, Trump's good at being a demagogue, even in the context of a debate. But I think when people see them next to each other and envision who they trust to run the United States of America, who they trust to carry us into the future, and then they think, is this a guy who we want to trust with his finger on the nuclear trigger, this guy with this temperament that, the other day he said, you know, if a bunch of Iranians in small boats were circling one of what he called our beautiful destroyers and making obscene gestures, we should blow them out of the water. What? I mean, do we want this guy in a situation room with more than a Twitter account? I mean, think about it. It's just terrifying. I think that is extremely important to make clear to people. Do they feel safe with this man as commander-in-chief or as the leader of this country? The other thing I think that is very important for us to drive home, all of us, is his record. His own record, as you know, this is not a man who's a tribune of ordinary people. This is a man who has done everything he can for himself, nothing but. He's bankrupted companies, screwed investors, screwed workers every time he can turn around. You work for him, he sues you. He says, sue me if you want to get paid everything you're owed. I mean, he's defrauded people through Trump University. He's tried to give payoffs to, like, the Attorney General of Florida. He has an empire that would completely compromise his, you know, American foreign policy if he were to become president. And look at what he's done when it comes to the question of disclosure. I mean, he's not made any disclosures about his health or speak of. And look at the disclosures he's made about his finances. Refuses to release his income tax returns. I mean, I'll tell you why I think that's true, by the way. And A, he's not worth as much as he claims. B, he probably paid no taxes over the last 10 years, speak of. Look at these huge tax breaks the New York Times reporting today. see. He doesn't give a lot of money away himself. He does it collects money from other people for his foundation and claims it to be his own. And finally, because he doesn't want us to know what kind of deals he's gotten with Russian oligarchs. I just think this guy is so unfit, so manifestly unfit, that once they get on a stage together, I think it's going to be very tough for him.
But as bad as he is and as dangerous as he is, I mean, he just, in Miami the other day, he again sort of tacitly implied that maybe somebody should shoot Hillary Clinton. You know, yep. Call for the disarming of the Secret Service bodyguards that she has, which he also has himself, by the way, and see what happens, he said. That's the second time he's made, I think, a pretty implicit, if not explicit, threats, even encouraging people to shoot Hillary Clinton. And he lies at every turn. He blamed Hillary Clinton for the birther movement, which Donald Trump was the main proponent of over 5 years. And you know, it's sort of like the internet world, where you can put anything up and the first headline is believed, and it takes days before anybody, if they even bother, to realize that it's total nonsense. So he's captured a kind of Kardashian culture of Twitterverse and Instagram.
Yep.
And I don't know how many Americans are in that world, as opposed to the more rational, traditional world of the dying newspapers and the Sunday morning political talk shows. So is that, do you think, where the divide...
I got to tell you, I think we have to compete in that same world that you just described. I mean, with the internet, with social media, by making it clear emotionally what this might mean to people. I mean, the things that make him... that really affect people when you talk to them about him are the fact that his divisiveness really, you know, insults huge chunks of the population. The fact that his temperament is such that they wouldn't trust him with the nuclear launch codes or anything else. His temperament is a huge factor here, I think, and it's very persuasive to people, turns out, when we look at polling. And finally is this question of his own personal record. You know, anybody who's a member of a labor union and thinks about voting for Trump, think again. He tried to deunionize his hotels or prevent his hotels from becoming unions. He's not for raising the minimum wage. He's a guy who's said people ought to work harder. They make too much. Is this really a guy who's looking out for ordinary working people? This is a guy who stiffs you as soon as look at you. I mean, that's when they look carefully at those things, and they don't have to look rationally, if you understand what I'm saying, you know, through some line of argument. This is not about comparing programs. This is about comparing the people. I think he's going to lose out when it comes to that, and that's what people are going to do in the next 50 days. And we're going to do everything we can as progressives to win, and I hope every one of your listeners will decide for whatever... Wherever you've been this election campaign so far, we can't afford not to get everyone to vote and to vote against Trump.
Well, just in closing, Bob Cremer, though, there's a disparity here, though, just in simple sloganeering. If you ask anybody, what does Donald Trump stand for? He stands for, we'll make America great again and we'll build a wall. But if you ask the same question of Hillary Clinton, it's not clear. Stronger together is not a proactive slogan. It's almost a reaction against Trump, who's divisive. That's the implication here. So is there any way that she can clarify her message, or, you know, basically stand for something clear, as opposed to, you know, she's got policy positions on 200 or 300 issues. They're incredibly in-depth. If you go to her website, there's no question that she's the competent person, unusually so, you know, probably the most qualified since George H.W. Bush. But I don't know that that is counting, given Trump's, you know, position in the polls.
I think you're correct that he has boiled his message down to a very simple set of slogans and positions, and appeals to fear, and in a way that makes it easy for him to say, just trust me, I don't have to tell you anything else. She certainly has to communicate to ordinary people that they can trust her to look out for them. They don't have necessarily to trust her on everything in the world. I mean, it's not like they're, you know, she's had this hard time because she's been attacked for 30 years of people feeling like they can fully trust her. I think that's, by the way, completely unfounded. I think she is extraordinarily trustworthy, but that's not the, you know, that you don't have to agree with me on that to agree that she can be trusted to look out for ordinary working people compared to Donald Trump. And that's the sale we got to make in the next, you know, 6 weeks. I think that's what it'll say. You know, if she convinces people in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, enough people that she is part of the elites and they're part of they're the movement for change, that could be very difficult. I don't think we're going to let them do that. And that's the importance of having Bernie and Elizabeth and everybody else out there is part of that, to prevent that from happening. And if we turn everybody out, I mean, that's the key part. Everybody's got to go to the polls. If they do that, I feel very confident that we will be successful. But there's a way in which I'm kind of glad, Ian, that it's not looking like a slam dunk and people say, oh, well, we can take that for granted, or we can throw our vote away on a third party and everybody's surprised election day. Nobody is now in a position to have the excuse of being surprised election day if Donald Trump becomes the next president of the United States. And that's why everybody has a personal responsibility now to really get out there and not only work to get other people there, but make sure they don't throw their vote away.
Well, Robert Kramer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Ian, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Kramer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He's a partner in Democracy Partners and a senior strategist for Americans United for Change, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump and the White Supremacist Alt-Right Are a Threat to Our National Security. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into polls that indicate a move to 30 third-party candidates away from Hillary Clinton, which appears to be helping Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. His latest article at The American Prospect is A Shifting Electoral Map Gives Democrats the Advantage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Meyerson.
Always good to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Harold. And your article indicates that while the move to third-party candidates away from Hillary Clinton appears to be helping Donald Trump, long-term demographic trends clearly favor progressives. So let's start with the bad news for Democrats, if you will, given this on this weekend where Hillary Clinton is behind 5 points in Ohio, in spite of the governor, the popular Republican governor, Kasich, not having endorsed Trump. She sent out her surrogates, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. She has an amazing pantheon of impressive political surrogates, along with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. She's got her husband, Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and Michelle Obama. So I'm frankly mystified as to why she's not 20 points ahead.
Well, if you look closely at some of these polls just in the last week, as to where her support has eroded most. It's clearly eroded most among millennials, among young voters, who are either now undecided or going to Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, respectively the Libertarian and Green candidates for president. It's really not as if, I think, there's a lot of investigation of what Gary Johnson in particular is, stands for, what he says, etc. And if you were a young person supporting Bernie Sanders, who stood for Medicare for All, and you're now supporting Gary Johnson, who stands for Medicare for None, that's a hell of a leap, you know. Some of this, I think, is driven by what was clear in the Democratic primary, which was a sense among young voters that Hillary Clinton was the old guard. What really made the Democratic primary, what made it really distinctive in American political history is there was really no such election that I can think of where the determining factor so clearly was age. 71% of voters under 30 voted for Sanders. 71% of voters over 65 voted for Clinton. And the higher you went in age groups, the more pro-Clinton it was, no matter how narrowly you sliced that. So she had a problem with younger voters going in. And in, the sort of moments of weakness and given the history of media piling on to her and the Republican narratives about who she is, often subtly dominating what the media is doing, in the last couple of weeks, she's seen real erosion among millennial voters. And the main challenge for Democrats, as I see it, is winning those voters back.
But do you think Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, I mean, they're just doing Ohio this weekend. There's obviously a lot more work to be done. What's your guess? Will we know whether this is working? I know Bernie Sanders made very strong cases. I saw him on a couple of television shows in the last few days. He was very clear. And of course, nobody's more qualified as a third-party candidate. He is the longest-serving independent candidate in the history of the United States Congress. And he's saying, clearly, don't vote for the third-party candidates. Vote for Hillary Clinton.
Well, we'll see if it works. I mean, ultimately, we won't see anything definitive until November 8th. But certainly, the more that Sanders and Warren can get out there and be on the stump and in the media saying this obviously helps. And, I might add that there's several issues really to drive home on this. One is this is a generation that is highly, racially and religiously tolerant. And so the distinctions between Clinton and Trump on that score are important to make. The environmental difference on environmental policy, on climate change, on global warming between Clinton and Trump need to be stressed, I think, for millennial voters as well. So, I mean, certainly the themes are out there. The credible spokespersons, as you yourself have just made clear, are out there. And but it also depends on things like the debates and how those go. So we will keep our fingers crossed and we will see.
And again, I'm speaking with Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. His latest article at The American Prospect is "A Shifting Electoral Map Gives Democrats the Advantage." Well, it is pretty mind-boggling. You mentioned the idea that the millennials would vote for Gary Johnson, and that appears to be where most of them are going. I'm not sure they're going to, they're certainly not going to Jill Stein in the same numbers that they're going to Gary Johnson. But not only does he not believe in government at all, he's an absolutely, his politics are identical to the Koch brothers, who are major libertarians. And he basically, just the other day, said that he would cut taxes and get rid of all regulation. So you cannot deal with global warming if you get rid of all environmental regulations. So it's pretty surreal to think that young people who care about these things And not to mention the fact that Gary Johnson the other day didn't know what Aleppo was. So what do you think it'll take to dissuade them? I mean, it's bad enough.
Well, I don't think this represents a shift in belief to libertarianism. I think Gary Johnson is functioning at the moment as the none of the above candidate. Historically, third-party candidates draw supporters who are clearly ideologically aligned with them. I don't think that's actually the case in terms of a lot of Johnson's support at this moment. He's simply the other guy. I think someone has got to, do pieces on what Gary Johnson actually stands for, and a lot of this has got to be just made clear that a vote for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein by people who otherwise would be voting for Hillary Clinton is a vote for Donald Trump.
Well, obviously that message has been out there since Florida 2000, where 96,000 people voted for Ralph Nader, and Al Gore lost by 527 votes. So it's pretty odd that lesson hasn't sunk in, but you can't blame people. You know, we're supposed to be a country of choice, the free country.
But that was 16 years ago, and we're talking about millennial voters.
Right, I get that,
So keep that in mind. And, that's why I also think to millennial voters, you need to have the extra dimension of saying what it is Gary Johnson stands for that actually you would be appalled about. The people who voted for Nader believed in what Ralph Nader believed. I think a lot of this movement towards Gary Johnson is not an affirmation of his beliefs. So that's the other basis on which to go after him.
So are we then to assume that Hillary Clinton's always going to be on her back foot all the way to November? As I mentioned in the previous interview, the simple fact that if you ask anybody, what does Donald Trump stand for? They'll immediately say, make America great again and build a wall. What does Hillary Clinton stand for? Well, if there's not a deadly silence, there's, well, stronger together, which is pretty lame, I think. It's more of a reaction against Trump than an affirmation of where she stands.
Yeah, well, I agree she needs a stronger message as to whether she's going to be on the back foot, between now and November. I think largely depends on the debates. This is a format where she's historically done well. It's a format in which Donald Trump has historically done well with the Republican electorate. He's not really a debate that wasn't a primary debate before. So it remains to be seen. But, I mean, in general, I think Clinton has a million policies, and as you pointed out, no one overarching theme. And I think that's actually true of globally and in the advanced industrial world anyway, of the center left generally right now. If you look at the French socialists, the British Labour Party, which is, having internal convulsions, the German Social Democrats, the Spanish Socialist Party and others, there is, a kind of muddled nature to the whole global center-left right now that is certainly disquieting, in which they're being challenged, as Hillary was in the primary, from a sharper left perspective that was in some ways more class-oriented, reflecting what capitalism in the advanced countries has become in recent years. Kind of xenophobic nativism, which is affecting all relatively centrist parties from the right. And so she's part of that, I think, collective vulnerability.
Well, the difference, though, in terms of the debates, while she herself is clearly seasoned, and I think Bernie Sanders made her a much better candidate, and she did well in those debates. You know, given her comment about the basket of deplorables and the way they handled her recent illness, you get the impression that she doesn't have really good people around her. I mean, last time around, Mark Penn was her campaign manager, and he was a manifest disaster. And I just don't get the feeling, in spite of this pantheon that I mentioned of surrogates that she's got, you know, the strongest political operators on the planet, some of them are Obama and Bill Clinton to begin with, and Bernie Sanders is an extraordinary draw, particularly for the very, very voters we're talking about here. But I get the impression that there's not an adult around there to tell her not to do things. I mean, she's maybe in a bubble of, sorority girls or something. But on the other side, we know that Donald Trump is preparing to debate with Roger Ailes, who is absolutely, the Darth Vader of politics. And I don't think I think he's going to be very effective.
Well, we'll see. I mean, some of the people around her, certainly her campaign chairperson, John Podesta, and her strategist, pollster, Joel Benenson, are very independent, sharp, good people to have around her. Obviously the person around her most, whose political counsel she has to take seriously, is Bill. We shall see. But you're right that there is a kind of there's been a kind of not going on the offensive enough since the convention. I mean, decision that is certainly open to all kinds of questioning and criticism is spending most of August not in public events, but in fundraisers. And, if you're not out there saying things and being on the offensive, in this context, you're going to be a target and in some ways a sitting duck. That was a mistake. That was a mistake to have her off the campaign trail and on the funding trail almost through the entirety of August.
But Howard Myerson, are you confident that Bill Clinton is her number one advisor? Because he's got such good political instincts. He would never have stressed the basket of deplorables over the latter part of her statement, which was really something that needs to be said, which is a compassionate...
She didn't say that as a conscious, strategic whatever.
It just, that was just bad.
It kind of slipped out. No, I'm sure Bill is. How could he not be? Her closest and most valued counselor. I mean, I don't doubt that. But these are different times, and much as Bill Clinton's political savvy is obviously immense, what worked in 1992 and 1996 doesn't necessarily work in 2016. It's a very different world.
Right. And frankly, I'm just nitpicking in a way that's kind of, I'm sure, irritating a lot of Democratic supporters of Hillary Clinton, because compared to Trump, she's just light years ahead in every possible category you can imagine. And it's sort of ridiculous to be criticizing her when this guy says the outrageous, racist, dangerous things like on Friday in Miami, encouraging his followers implying that somebody should assassinate Hillary Clinton, blaming her for the Bertha movement. I mean, it's just the difference between these two is night and day. So, in a way, criticizing her is in itself somewhat misplaced.
It is. Yes, you see this in the mainstream media all the time. You see, stories that essentially deal with exactly the sort of thing you're talking about, the false equivalence of what she may say in an unguarded moment to the entire weight of the Trump campaign vilifying all kinds of, races and religions and what have you. So, I think only in the last week and a half have I started to see stories in the media questioning its own handling of the race. And so we'll see how that goes as we go forward.
Well, I believe that Matt Lauer has been sent to talk show host Siberia. So.
Let us hope, on bread and water, yeah.
Well, Harold Meyerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thank you again. I've been speaking with Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. His latest article at The American Prospect is A Shifting Electoral Map Gives Democrats the Advantage. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a 7-point plan to defeat Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kevin O'Leary, who's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America, and his latest book is Trump and the Roots of Rage, The Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin O'Leary.
Ian, thank you very much.
And I want to get to your 7-point plan to defeat Donald Trump because it sounds like it's very much needed at the moment, given how close he is to Hillary Clinton in a lot of polls. And he's been on the way up and she's been on the way down. We discussed just then with Harold Meyerson why she's losing votes, millennial votes, to Gary Johnson. But to begin with, do you have a diagnosis for why this manifestly dangerous and unqualified, reckless and possibly unstable candidate is doing as well as he can, and why this incredibly experienced, qualified candidate is not doing as well as she should be?
Let me start with the second about Hillary not doing as well. I think she's always... You know, when you're the spouse of somebody who is as talented a politician as Bill Clinton, you're never quite going to be that good on the stump. She's really good. I think sometimes the press just gets in the habit of criticizing her because they think, well, she's not quite as good as Bill when she makes a speech. And then more than that, it's just her whole career from being first lady and, you know, instead of being a typical first lady but taking charge, being the point person on health care. That put her under the fire of the right from the beginning, and they just went after her. And, you know, I don't know what the culture of politics was in Arkansas, but that came with them, and people have always been after the two of them. And it's been unfortunate for Hillary that she's been damaged by that, because it's a big thing when you're running for president is it's just, do you like the person? Do you trust the person? And the right has been trying to cut that connection between Hillary as a candidate and the public forever, even Benghazi right now. So I'd say my first thing would be, look, people need, liberals and progressives need to defend Hillary, and we need to tell the press to cover it differently. Because your last point with Harold, I think you guys made a real good point about the press coverage. This is not a normal election, and the reporters and editors need to know that. This is not a normal horse race. This is a serious situation we're in. And it's not fair to cover the two candidates as if, you know, having pneumonia and not coming forth the day before to say, I've got full-blown pneumonia, versus what Trump does every day. He does so many things that he just covers his tracks and the press can't keep up. So that's number one, defend Hillary. Number two, on defending Hillary, take Benghazi and point out to people that they've been pounding on something, and the comparison people can make is with Ronald Reagan and Beirut. For God's sakes, four people tragically lost their lives in Libya, right? The ambassador was taking a risk going to the consulate. He knew Arabic. He wanted to be among the people. He had a small detachment. Sometimes bad things happen overseas. And it wasn't anybody's fault as such, and it certainly wasn't Hillary's fault. To blame her the way the Republicans have, and just to look back and say, there's no comparison. Reagan goes in and he puts almost 300 troops in danger, and almost 300 troops, Marines, lose their lives in Beirut. There was never any investigation. The Democrats never did this thing. So I think Democrats need to do, liberals, progressives need to do a better job of defending Hillary and saying, this is all bogus stuff from the right. Let's see. Now, in terms of Trump and why he's where he is, I think my book is, you know, I try to probe where Trumpism came from, how the GOP's continued to move from to the right, especially since Gingrich. And I make this argument that we are really not a conservative country. We're a deeply liberal nation in terms of our philosophy. And this includes classic conservatives like Bob Dole and George F. Will. And what we have, and what most of Americans and most ordinary Americans would agree with this if they stop and think, is we reject the old world. When we came to America, we rejected feudalism and monarchy, and what we rejected in specific was four values. We said no to a society based on privilege, no to a society based on hierarchy, no to a society based on inequality, and no to a society based on exclusion. Well, guess what? There was one part of the country where those values were enshrined and where aristocracy continued to reign, and that was the Old South with the plantation owners. And the key mistake in American history, if you want to point at one crucial mistake, was Lincoln led the effort. We free the slaves. We win the war. Lincoln loses his life. And Thaddeus Stevens is trying to get the North to break up the plantations. If it was a different country, Thaddeus Stevens, somebody else, we would have been saying, string those people up and kill them. We didn't do that. We're magnanimous. But we shouldn't have let the plantation owners keep those big plantations, because what they did was they kept their power. And so from 1865 to 1965, the old ideology of the South ruled. And that was so fundamentally anti-American that that is still there underneath in some people.
Right. Well,
that ideology, that ideology of the South married with the hard right libertarian part of Goldwater and Hayek, that when that marriage happened, those two things came together and that took over the Republican Party. And that's a classic recipe for reactionary politics.
Well, indeed, I think if you really describe the Republican Party, it is a Southern party with the Koch brothers' libertarian wing as well. And again, I'm speaking with Kevin O'Leary, who's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America. And his latest book is Trump and the Roots of Rage, the Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat. And clearly you've got people like, you know, the Southern politician Jeff Sessions supporting Trump.
Yes, one of his close advisors.
But on the other hand, you do have Paul Ryan. You do have Mitch McConnell. Of course, the Democrats are running complete locks against him, which is, shows you how stupid they can be. They could have knocked him off. The problem is that these people, the Republican establishment at the moment, are what James Fellows describes as the Vichy Republicans. They are not speaking out against this racist demagogue who's captured their party.
Yes, because they have benefited all these years from dog whistle politics, and they just wish Trump could control himself a little bit better and not do a train horn when he's giving out the racist message. But the libertarians, here, what happened? The key thing that happened with this combination was George Wallace came along. He found that the old Southern demagogues with a straight-up hatred against against blacks wasn't going to fly, and he sublimated that rage, that racial rage, to a hatred of government, which married up perfectly with what the libertarians want to do. So if you read the old libertarian classics like Hayek, and you read Ayn Rand and her novels, and the stuff that that Paul Ryan and Ted Cruz grew up on, it's nasty stuff in one sense. And then you get McConnell, who's an opportunist, who just wants power. He always wanted to be Senate Majority Leader, and he got that power. So they have benefited from what's been going on, and now they've got this guy Trump, and they wish he would just have a sweeter way. And in a sense, that's the real danger that's going on here long term. If we can defeat Trump now, he's a very talented guy, but he is outlandish, and he does step on himself sometimes. Great, but this chemistry is still out there, and it's open for somebody else to come along and be a little more subtle with it. And these people like Ryan and McConnell, they should be calling out Trump. More people should be calling out. And that's like, you look, when she made the deplorable comment, when Hillary Clinton made the deplorable comment, she's talking about maybe 20% of the electorate. That's half of the Republican electorate. But what about the other half? What's this, when they get to 40, 45% for Trump support, what about those conservatives who aren't bigoted? Why are they still with a guy like Trump? And that's part of the reason. So if we get into my points of how we should go at this, I'll go toward that.
Yeah, well, let's do that. Let's go through your 7-point plan to defeat Donald Trump that's in your new book, Trump and the Roots of Rage, the Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat.
Okay, I'm going to start with one that's not on the list, but just because Harold raised it and because of the rise of Gary Johnson. I think part of that is right. Johnson is this other choice, and so it's, you know, they have people see it as two evils, and they say, I'll go here. Harold's right. We got to point out what he stands for and his libertarian no government. This whole thing about the hardcore libertarians, to have people say, they basically saying no government is what we should have, that the market can solve all. Is just so false. So classic conservatives believe in government, from Edmund Burke to Alexander Hamilton to George Will, Bob Dole. People believe in government. It's just the particular policies. So that's one. But let me go into the seven. The seven would be that I'd say, and to preface this, to win, the Democrats have an opportunity. We can win by mobilizing the liberal base, but we also want to try to break up the Republican coalition. We want to keep both things in mind as we push on this. And the first thing is, as we talked about, is number one of a 7-point plan would be to portray Trump as the monster that he is. You know, he's not just a game show type guy. He's just not a reality TV guy. And you can make fun of him. And you go back to the whole thing of Postman's book, Entertaining Ourselves to Death. And so we want to take this seriously. And the closeness of the race is causing the media to do that. And I think we should stay on the media to make them cover the race seriously. Number two, the point we've just been talking about, number two would be to attack the GOP establishment for lacking moral courage. Exactly the point that James Fallows is making, that they're collaborators with this. And the fact that Trump has the chutzpah to, what, make his message, and the article I did for the American Prospect in the summer was about Trump as a Southern demagogue. He's all about trust me and fear them, and has very little in terms of substance. And that message, what the old demagogues did before Wallace, was they just directly go after blacks in an awful way. And Trump has now generalized that to uppity women, to immigrants, to Muslims, to whoever who's not a white male. And then white males are caused to stay with him because they think, well, I'd like to be like that. I'd like it to be like it was in the 1950s. And that's a very direct, simplified way of talking about it. But that's one of the dynamics going on here. So we need to challenge the GOP establishment for lacking moral courage. Number three, I would say we've got to be careful not to define liberalism just as a cultural thing about its being, you know, we're socially liberal. No, we're about the New Deal working. This is about economic liberalism, and that's why Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's campaigns and presence on the national stage have been so valuable, because they've brought the economic issues back to the fore, and we need to pound on that, because that links to number five, or I'll get to that. Number five would be locking down the Latino vote. They've opened themselves up with Trump's you know, calling Mexican Americans rapists and the people coming from Latin America as rapists, and his attack on the judge, et cetera, that he's opened himself up that the Latino vote, we can lock it down if the Democrats are smart about this, the same way we locked down the black vote back with the 60s. Back to the point about the economic message. This is really important. I really think, yes, Hillary's campaign and the Democrats, there's all this news media articles about they're looking for the upper, kind of the middle class, college-educated voters, suburban women, et cetera, et cetera. We make a mistake as Democrats if we give up on working-class folks and if we define that as non-college-educated. Those people need help. They are looking for government to help them. Not all the Trump people that support him right now are bigoted, but they're looking for government to help them, and it's been a long time since it has for some of these folks. And Democrats traditionally have been about that ever since the New Deal, ever since the Progressive Era. We've been about working class issues and helping ordinary Americans get ahead. And so the opportunity is there for us to take part of the Trump vote from him because we actually get things done and we actually have programs that work. And then finally, a couple more points, 6 and 7 would be keep working to break the back of the GOP South, that we need to keep doing well in North Carolina, push on Georgia, Virginia, we seem to have been making really good progress. That, if we could break the back of the GOP in the South, that will go a long way to taking care of this really bad problem we have in terms of the Republicans moving to the right because they've given up on classic conservatism. We need to make it so Republicans go back to the party that they used to have where they were sane, to put it simply. And then 7 would be basically proud to defend government. When people question about government, oh, it never works, just the whole line we've had since Reagan and forever, we liberals and progressives need to defend government and point out the programs that do work and the things that Hillary has specifically said she's going to do. That's a summary.
Well, Kevin O'Leary, I thank you very much for joining us. I'm glad we got your 7 points across, and I hope that people get hold of your book, Trump and the Roots of Rage, The Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat. And again, I've been speaking with Kevin O'Leary, who's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America. And his latest book is Trump and the Roots of Rage, The Republican Right and the Authoritarian Threat. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.